Radha Kunda Giri Govardhana Ki Jai, Vrindavan Dhamma Ki Jai, Mathura Dhamma Ki Jai, Jagannath Puri Dhamma Ki Jai, Gangamaya Jamuna Devi Ki Jai, Tulsi Maharani Ki Jai, Samaveta Bhaktarinda Ki Jai, Gaur Premanande. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnupadaya. Krishna Prastaya Bhutale Srimati Bhaktivedanta Swami Niti Namane Namaste Sarasvati Deve Gauravani Pacharane Nirvasesa Sanyavadi Paskachyade Sitarane Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Utapadakamalam Sri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Bikams Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Sri Vishakam Bikamscha Panchakalpa Trubhischa Kripa Sindhuvyevacha Patitanam Pavanevyo Vaishnavevi Namo Namaha Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
September 25th, 2015, a Skype class from Hilo, Hawaii about the incarnation of the Lord Vamandev. And we have some slides here. The slide presentation is really part of a larger presentation that... Somehow... Oh, I must be seeing your screen.
No, I think we see your screen.
No, I'm not. I'm seeing... Okay.
Yeah, we see your desktop.
Now, okay. Now I'm seeing the right thing. So this is really part of a larger presentation that has all of these topics. But today we're probably just going to be doing the first one. We might touch on the second one. Tomorrow night, the plan is that... we're going to be showing the entire presentation. So if you live locally on the Big Island, you are welcome. Okay, going to the story of Bali.
I'll unmute everybody. Yep.
So in this material world, we are constantly dealing with the friends, the enemies, and the neutral. And in this world, we define friends as people who help me achieve my material desires, help me gain my sense gratification, help me gain what I want. My enemies are those who impede it, and the neutral are people who neither facilitate nor impede.
Muted. Unmuted.
The basic mood of a materialistic person is I help my friends because they help me, and I try to neutralize my enemies because if I neutralize all my enemies in some way, then I would have an open path. I'd be unimpeded. We find this mentality is particularly that of the demons. Krishna talks about it in the 16th chapter. We read about it with Kamsa, how Kamsa was saying that he's imprisoned his father, he's imprisoned Vasudev and going to kill all of his children. And he's made alliances with many other kings, and in this way, his plans will be unimpeded. We find the mentality also in Hiranyakashipu, who asks a boon from Lord Brahma that he will have no rival, that he'll be the undisputed ruler of the universe. So each of us, in our own little way, is trying to do that. We're trying to get the enemies out of our life, or we're trying to make them impotent, and we facilitate our friends, and we're neutral toward the neutral. This mentality goes all the way up to the demigods. Anyone who is not free of the modes of material nature is in this mood of friends, enemies, and neutral. For those who want to become fully transcendental to the modes of material nature, to those who want to become liberated, to those who want to go back to home, back to Godhead, and experience love of God, this vision of the world as friends, enemies, and neutral has to be abandoned. Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati said that those who criticize him are his real friends, and those who flatter him are his real enemies. He reversed it. He said those who are seeing the world as friends are enemies, and those who are seeing the world as enemies are friends. But really, everyone is a friend. Everyone is helping us in one way or another to come closer to Krishna. And when one wants to achieve pure love of God or even liberation, the Lord helps that person by arranging their life to facilitate their desires, just as the Lord helps all living entities to facilitate their desires. And here in this picture, we see a typical friends and enemies mentality. We see Bali Maharaj has come to the heavenly planets with a huge army blowing his conch shell. So the mentality of Bali Maharaj is also typical of somebody in the mode of ignorance or passion in ignorance, but particularly in ignorance. And that is and not only seeing the world as friends and enemies, but thinking that I will get what I want by force. I will get what I want by power. I will get what I want through cheating. I'm not going to get what I want through the legitimate means. So who wouldn't want to be the king of heaven? I mean, every conditioned soul wants to go to heaven, wants to go to a perfect heavenly place. And what to speak of being the king of heaven? To have all of the facilities of heaven at one's disposal. This is the secret wish of all conditioned souls. Let me be the king of heaven. But if you want to be the king of heaven, you have to perform a lot of austerities. You have to be a very pious person, because Krishna doesn't want the king of heaven, the chief administrative demigod in the universe, to be an evil person. So Indra, the jiva who takes this post of Indra means the chief, he has to be a very pious person. He has to be something of a devotee of the Lord. So Bali Maharaj didn't want to go through that route. Bali Maharaj wanted to conquer the kingdom of heaven in another way. Now, Bali took advantage of the fact that one can conquer, that one can get facility by the grace of the brahmanas or by the grace of devotees. So he basically was able to get this kingdom of heaven by pleasing a brahmana, his guru, Sukra Acharya. And because he had pleased Sukra Acharya, therefore he was able to get the potency, the shakti, to conquer heaven. Now Indra, in comparison, had displeased his guru. Indra was in his assembly hall with all of his courtiers and etc., all of his associates. And when his guru, Brihaspati, had entered, Indra had intentionally ignored him. He hadn't stood up from his throne. He didn't even say hello. And because of this offense towards Brihaspati, he ended up losing his kingdom. So Indra sees that Bali Maharaj is coming. And Indra makes a very wise decision. And this is something that Jesus talks about in the Bible. He says, if an enemy is coming that outnumbers you, then you don't fight with them. That a fight should be done only if there's a chance of winning. And there's one of our Gaudiya Acharyas who makes this point also. That you don't take on, I think it's Bhaktivinoda Thakur, you don't take on some sort of project or some sort of battle if you're destined to lose. You don't take on a failing mission, and the demons tend to do this. You know, Ravana continuing to fight with Ram even after Kumbhakarna, Indrajit, etc. have all been killed, and it's obvious he's no longer going to win. Or Kamsa, who continues to oppose Krishna even after the elephant, Kuvalayapita, the wrestlers, Chanura Mustika, even after they've all been defeated, killed, still he's persisting. But an intelligent person knows, as they say in that song, when to hold them, when to fold them. You know, when do I walk away? At what point do I say, this is not working, and you quit? The determination in the mode of goodness that is unattached to success or failure and goes on without consideration of success or failure is a determination to please the Lord. It's not necessarily a determination to get a particular result. That's very much in the mode of passion. So Indra, being influenced by the mode of goodness, not by Sattvagun, he's saying that this Bali is stronger than me, and he's not going to be able to conquer me. Now, he understood that by going to Lord Vishnu. The Lord himself said, you're not going to be able to conquer the demons at this time. Time will be with you later. So the reason, again, was that Bali had pleased the Brahmins and the Vaishnavas, and Indra had displeased them. And what the Lord is going to do is he's going to arrange that Bali displeases the Brahmanas. So this principle that pleasing or displeasing the saintly persons and the Brahmanas is higher than ordinary karma is very important for us as devotees of Krishna. We are not trying to earn our way back to the kingdom of God at all. We're not trying to amass some amount of ordinary karmic activities. We are trying to amass amount of bhakti, but we're not trying to amass amount of just ordinary pious activities with the idea that now I've earned the right to go back to Godhead by my good works. But in the material world, that is certainly the case. One earns one's particular body and one's status by one's good and bad works. But the trump card is how one deals with the devotees and the brahmanas. If one deals badly with the devotees and the brahmanas, one can lose all of one's accumulated merit. And if one deals well with them, one jumps ahead. You know, like there's a game my four-year-old grandson plays, Krishna Land, where certain cards you get to jump ahead on the board, or you jump behind on the board. So this pleasing or displeasing the devotees and the saintly persons, this is that kind of a card. And why is that? Because the whole essence of reality is the pleasure of the Lord and his devotees. That is what truth is. Truth is about loving, caring relationships, and truth is about giving and pleasing others, especially pleasing the saintly persons. And that's a lot more important than any so-called good works. So Indra and the demigods take various forms, some of them like birds and animals, etc., and they leave the heavenly planets without fighting. So again, to know when to just leave. And Bali Maharaj takes over heaven. So the mother of Indra, Aditi, she's very upset about this situation. Here her sons have left their kingdom, pushed out by the demons. Now, a little side note here is these demons are the children, grandchildren, so forth, of Aditi's sister and co-wife, Diti. So really, this is a family feud, something like the Mahabharata, and the persons on either side of this, they're half-brothers. Diti and Aditi, again, they're sisters, so their children would be cousins, but as they are both married to the same man, to Kasyapa, their children are half-brothers, half-sisters. So this really is a difficulty within a family. But, you know, even in a family, no parent likes it when one brother, one sister takes the belongings of another. We like it when our family is living together in harmony. One of the most pleasing things to parents, grandparents, aunts, uncles, is when they see that everyone in the family is getting along in harmony. When there's discord in the family, it's very, very painful. I know when my sister refused to speak to me once I became a devotee, until she was diagnosed with cancer, then she spoke to me. But it was very painful for my mother. It was actually more painful for my mother than for us. And this is certainly the feeling of Krishna, that he wants all the living entities to get along with respect. It's this concept of respect and serving is the, again, it's the essential principle of truth. So Aditi is certainly concerned about that. She doesn't like that her sons have legitimately been the head of the kingdom of heaven, and that these descendants of her stepson, Bali is not her stepson directly, but is a descendant of her stepson, that he's usurped the rightful property of her own sons. So she doesn't like this on several counts. First of all, because she has some attachment to her own children, over her attachment to the children of her sister. So she has some material attachment here. But also because she wants things to be harmonious for the pleasure of the Lord. Lord. And another one of her motives is she's a great devotee of the Lord, and she knows that the Lord himself wants his devotees to be in charge of the universe. She knows that the Lord doesn't like it when people opposed to him are in charge. So she becomes very despondent. And her husband, who was absorbed in meditation, comes home and he says, "Why are you despondent? Why is the house not taken care of? Why are things in disarray?" And we all have our shastric enjoined duties, and one of the duties of the wife, not the only duty of the wife, but one of the duties of the wife is to make sure that the house is neat and clean and fragrant. So this is her responsibility. That doesn't necessarily mean she does it herself. Wealthy people have always had servants, but it's her responsibility to make sure that it is done. That's her God-given duty. But because she was depressed, she wasn't doing it. That's one of the symptoms, right, of being sad or depressed. You start neglecting your duties. So Kasyapa came back and says, "Why have your duties been neglected? Why are you sorrowful?" And when she told him the reason, then he said, "Oh, you're so foolish." He looked at the side. He looked at the attachment side. He said, "But all right, you know, you're my wife. I'll help you. You can do this yajna. And if you do this yajna, your problem will be solved." So Aditi did a yajna. And we know that there's a number of places in the Bhagavatam where women are doing yajnas, vratas and yajnas. The concept that that is only for men is not supported by the shastra. And from doing this yajna, she saw the Lord personally. So that should be the results, right? The result of all of our activities should be a personal relationship with Krishna. Yagyartat karmano natra loko yam karma bandana taratam karma kantaya mukta sangha samatra. Everything should be ultimately to please the Lord. Even if it's mixed with our own desires, there should be some desire to please the Lord. So the Lord came and was indeed pleased. And as soon as she saw the Lord, then she offered full dandavats on the ground. And she was exhibiting all of the symptoms of ecstasy. And she offered prayers to the Lord. And then, very interesting, the Lord said to her, "I already knew what you wanted." And, of course, most of us tend to pray to the Lord to ask for things for ourselves. This is probably the most common type of prayer that a human being makes to the Lord. Please do this for me, please do that for me. Which is much better than the demons who don't ask the Lord for anything and think they can do everything themselves. So that shows some dependence on the Lord. But the Lord actually already knows what we need. And one who has faith in that, one who has faith that the Lord already knows what they need, simply says, "How may I serve you? How may I serve you? And I have faith that you are providing everything perfectly for me." Of course, the Lord then likes to ask his devotees, "What do you want?" And the devotees say, "Please just let me serve you. Let me be absorbed in you. Let me help others." So the Lord assured her, he said, "I'm going to help you. And the way I'm going to help you is by becoming one of your sons. I'm going to become the brother of Indra." And I find it quite interesting how the Lord solves problems. If some people had occupied my son's home and thrown him out of his job and etc., and I prayed to Krishna, "Please, you know, destroy my son's enemies and restore my son's home and restore my son's work," I expect, you know, some kind of behind-the-scenes miracle, perhaps, or maybe the Lord comes in, you know, with his Sudarshan Chakra. But the Lord likes to solve problems in a very playful way. And sometimes he does come like that, like on the shore of the ocean of milk when the demigods and demons are fighting and the Lord comes on Garuda with his weapons. But before that, he had come as Mohini. Right? And when there's floods in Vrindavan, the Lord lifts Govardhan Hill. I mean, he has many different playful ways of dealing with our problems. Sometimes he just comes and smashes the demon in two with his fist and his chakra or whatever. And other times he has these playful narrative ways of doing it. So, "I'm going to come as your son." Of course, one reason that the Lord did this, again, is that Bali had pleased the Brahmanas and Indra had displeased the Brahmanas. And so the Lord does not like to just simply by force interfere when people have followed these principles. because he wants everyone in the universe to know that if I follow these principles, I'll get this particular result. The Lord wants things to be fair. He has this quality of being dependable, where even the demons will know, all right, if I please the devotees, if I please the brahmanas, if I follow the rules, then I will also get facility in the world. The Lord doesn't have nepotism. We say he favors his devotees, but that's not because they're unqualified. Krishna is not unfair. He therefore wants to set up a situation where someone is likely to break the universal law, especially of displeasing the devotees, and that way everything is still within the structure of the universe. A similar thing he did with having Prahlad become the son of Hiranyakashipu. So then the Lord appears as Vamana. Vamana literally means a dwarf. And he's, of course, a brahmana, as Kasyapa and Aditi are great brahmanas in the universe. And when he appears, he's appearing as a demigod. And the demigods, of course, there's a short pregnancy and they grow up very fast. They don't have the long childhood of the earthly humans. And so here he was already, not as a baby. And the demigods and the demigoddesses all come to give him gifts. They give him a clothing and a belt and beads and an umbrella and a water pot, and they're all showering him with gifts. And we find, like when Krishna built his Sudharma assembly house, that all the demigods gave gifts for the assembly house. So this is the mood of the devotees. The mood of the devotees is not what can I take from the Lord, but what can I give to the Lord. And, of course, they gave according to their particular opulences, their particular shaktis. Now, meanwhile, Bali Maharaj was very intelligent. So he knew, all right, I was able to conquer the heavenly planets, but how am I going to keep it? Just like with Hiranyakashipu, when Brahma gave Hiranyakashipu his benedictions, he cautioned him that what I'm giving you is very difficult to maintain. So maintenance is much more difficult than creation. Anybody who owns a house or anybody who owns a car will attest to that, or anyone who's had a child or anyone who's gotten married. You know, getting married is fairly easy. I mean, nowadays, perhaps it's hard to find a good person to marry, but used to be fairly easy. Your parents arranged for it, and pretty much everybody got married. But the wedding itself is a fairly easy affair, but having a good and happy marriage is hard work. Right? Just producing a child, I mean, anyone who is biologically healthy can produce a child, but raising the child, maintaining the child, is difficult. Right? Building a house is hard work, but maintaining it over the long haul, it's a lot harder. So Bali Maharaj understood that unless he did yajñas, he wouldn't be able to maintain his position. So under the guidance of Sukracharya, he's doing yajñas to keep his place in the heavenly planets. So during one of these yajñas, Vamandev appears. And he comes as a very small Brahmana boy. Now, why did he take this particular mood? He took this particular mood because, first of all, people are charmed by young children. So most adults find young children very charming. And you naturally want to give little children whatever they ask for, if they ask for it sweetly. So we have, like my 2-year-old grandson here, he likes to get water and ice, not to drink, but to play with. And he'll set up 2 containers on the floor and he'll pour the water or the ice from one to the other and make a big mess. And my son, his father, used to do that also at that age. And I remember we were living in the Boston Temple, and he would take a cup or a bowl and he'd walk over to the sink and he'd ask one of the ladies in the ashram, you know, for water. He couldn't say water, he could say more. So he'd hold up his little bowl and he'd go, "More? More?" in this sweet little voice. And so, of course, they would give him water. And then he would walk back down the hallway and get out his bowls and he'd pour the water from one bowl to another until there was a mess. And the ladies would come to me and say, "Why do you let your son make a mess in the hallway?" I said, "Why do you give him water?" is that, oh, he's so sweet when he asks. So this is the mood that when a little child asks for something, you naturally, your heart just naturally melts and you want to give them what they ask for. Also, they don't seem particularly threatening. Right? It's a little child, what are they going to do? You're naturally so much more powerful than them, so you don't feel threatened from them, by them. Additionally, coming in the form of a brahmana, and Bali's here as an administrative demigod, as a kshatriya, so the rulers were trained that whatever the brahmanas want, you give them. Indeed, again, that's how Bali got this position, was by serving the brahmanas. So naturally, he's going to be inclined, both by religious scripture and by his own mood, to give to a brahmana, and then naturally to a child. So as Vamandeva is walking, his effulgence is like the sun or like one of the fire gods, and he's pressing down the earth with each step. And he's so beautiful that all of the persons assisting Bali in the sacrifice, they all become distracted and they look at him. So such should be our mood in our devotional life, that we should become distracted from our absorption in matter by the beauty, the effulgence, and the power of the Lord. Unfortunately, generally, we become distracted from the attractiveness of the Lord to become attracted to his energy of illusion instead. But we want to turn our face away from the illusion back to the reality. We want the reality to distract us more and more and more until we are fully absorbed in it. All right, now we have a problem. So Vamandeva comes, and Bali Maharaj gives him a nice seat, a nice welcome. All the brahmanas are enchanted by him. And Bali says, oh, my dear boy, what would you like? And Bali gives a list of everything that he can give Vamandeva as a gift. You know, I can give you land, I can give you palaces, we'll arrange a nice brahmana girl to marry you. What would you like? And Vamandeva says, oh, I would like a little bit of land, as much as I can measure with my own feet in 3 steps. So it's interesting, not only did Vamandeva take the form of a child, but he took the mood also of a child. And Bali took this as a very childish request. Right? Like Prabhupada says, you don't go to a king and ask him for a few grains of rice. So, you know, you don't go to the person ruling the universe and say, can I have a tiny little spot of land? I mean, if any of us measure 3 steps, that's probably, you know, a little bigger than a bed. So if you measured off a 3-step place, be enough room to put, you know, a bed and a chair and maybe some shelves. So a tiny, tiny, tiny little place. And that you could, it reminds me of the room I lived in for about a year in the Boston Temple, where I had a room for, you know, some drawers, a chest of drawers, a bureau, and a rocking chair, and then I could put out a sleeping bag at night. So that's basically what he was asking for. And Bali says something interesting here. He says, you should ask me for something so great that you'll never have to ask anybody for anything else ever. Now, the only person that can give such a benediction is God. And Bali Maharaj had some pride here, that I can give you such a great benediction that you will be eternally satisfied. You'll never ask for anything else. Indeed, that is the benediction we should ask for from the Lord. We should go to the Lord and say, please give me something so great and so wonderful that I'll never have any inclination to ask for anything else ever from anybody. That all of my desires will be satisfied. Sometimes devotees think that they should artificially pretend that they have no desires and go to the Lord just saying, give me pure devotional service. You can try it, but it doesn't work. The Lord's not interested in something phony or artificial. But we can go to the Lord and say, listen, I have all these desires. You know, I want a beautiful wife or husband. I want a gorgeous house overlooking the ocean. I want $10 million or euros or whatever in the bank. And I want everyone to adore me. I want all my enemies to, you know, choke in the dust, whatever. You know, I this is what I want, but why don't you give me something so great that I won't care about any of those things? Give me such a great benediction that my urge for all of those things dissipates automatically. So this is what Balimar said to Vamandev, and Vamandev said to him, I'm a Brahmana, and I have no business being greedy. He said, and then he's kind of indirectly preaching to Bali. If we want a good example of how to preach, we can take Vamandev's example. He said, if I'm not going to be satisfied with a small hut, a small piece of land, then I wouldn't be satisfied with the three worlds. And in fact, we find that the more, that, you know, we get more indifferent, etc., in this world. But if we have the wrong consciousness, we're never satisfied. What's fascinating is that first we need to be satisfied with exactly what we have. And if we're satisfied with exactly what we have, then we will feel satisfaction always with exactly what we have. One saintly devotee that I know, I asked her, what can I do for you? What do you need? She said, I need whatever I have. She didn't say, I have what I need. She said, I need whatever I have. And this should be the mood, especially of a Brahmana, and what to speak of a devotee. I need whatever I have. Whatever I have is sufficient to fulfill my needs. We may have a duty. One may have a duty to earn a livelihood, etc. But we have a duty to fix our residence, but that's out of duty, not out of a sense of greed. So Vamandev basically said to Bali, "You were greedy. You were greedy, and you're not going to be satisfied even with Indra's kingdom." Just like Hiranyakashipu was ruling the universe, but he still wasn't satisfied. He was always yelling at the demigods, always getting intoxicated. He showed signs of dissatisfaction even after getting everything he wanted. And of course, the reason for that dissatisfaction is on many levels, but on one level is that nothing we get in this world has anything to do with us. Someone told me this the other day. They said, I have this terrible problem. And then said right afterwards, it really isn't my problem. It has nothing to do with me. I'm just the observer. So because we're just the observer, not only do our problems have nothing to do with us, but even our material benedictions have nothing to do with us. If we're very wealthy, we're not really enjoying that wealth. If we're very poor, we're not really in poverty, and so forth. Now, Sukracharya didn't like this request of Vamandev, but Balimaraj just sort of automatically, he was so charmed, and he said, yes, I will give you what you want. Now, in those days, your word was considered as solid as stone. You know, you give your word to somebody, that's it. They didn't need written, notarized contracts with a lawyer. If you gave your oral contract, of course, even today oral contracts have the force of law, but in those days, an oral contract was sufficient. So Bali Maharaj was about to pour the water into Vamandev's hand to seal the deal, so to speak, and Sukracharya gets involved. Now, Sukracharya didn't have the innate faith of Bali Maharaj, nor was he as charmed by Vamandev. With his Brahma Tejas, he could understand that Vamandev was Vishnu. And he said, this is a trick. He's going to take everything from you. Now, Sukracharya, we have to say, wasn't particularly concerned about whether Vamandev took everything from Bali. But because Sukracharya was being maintained by Bali, he was also living in the heavenly planets, he didn't want to lose his position. So we often have this, people who come saying, this is for you, I'm giving you advice for you, this is really about you, and it really isn't about us at all. It's really about what they can get for themselves. So Bali here makes the fateful decision to go against his spiritual master. And this example of Bali going against his guru is one of the examples that one can do sarva dharma pricha jama me kam sharanam braja ham tvam sarva papevyo mokshishyami masujaha. That to surrender to the Lord, one can reject any ordinary dharma. Now, generally, the devotee follows ordinary dharma as a service to the Lord, because generally the Lord wants people to follow ordinary dharma, because dharmantu sakshat bhagavat pranitam, ordinary dharma has come from the Lord. So generally speaking, almost all the time, 99.999% of the time, the way we serve the Lord is by following even these lower forms of dharma. But we follow them not to be a righteous person, not to be a good person, not to get the accolades of the public, not to go to heaven. We follow them to please the Lord. And because the purpose of our following mundane dharma is to please the Lord, if it will please the Lord to abnegate our mundane dharma, we will also do that. Because the purpose is to please the Lord. I just like, even in ordinary life, let's say you had a family, you know, where the husband said to his wife, I always want the dishes washed right after dinner. I remember staying with a family like that, where they didn't want any dirty dishes in the sink ever. You know, so I always want the dishes washed right after dinner. But then suppose right at dinner, the husband says to his wife, hey, it's a place I really want to go. Someone's having this devotional program. And she says, but my dear husband, you know, if we go to that program on time, I won't have time to wash the dishes right after dinner. You know, he says, but I'm telling you now to go to the program. There's a nice conversation between Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and I believe it's Pala Babata. Bala Babata is criticizing the Lord for chanting the Hare Krishna mantra. And he says, a chaste woman does not say the name of her husband. I mean, nowadays, at least in the West, it's very common, you know, the woman calls her wife Dave or Joe or whatever. But in Vedic times, Vedic society, you don't call your superiors by name. Just like the children, they don't call their mother and father John and Sue, they call them mother and father. So generally the wife calls her husband Swami or Pati or Prabhu, but she doesn't call him by his name. So Vallabhata says, God is the supreme husband, why are you calling him by name? And Lord Chaitanya says, you don't know anything about the principles of religion. He says, the principles of religion is to follow the order of the husband. And it's Krishna who's telling us, chant my name, Satyatam Kirtayanto Mam, Satyatam Kirtayanto Mam. So therefore we chant the Lord's holy name. So Bali Maharaj here is rejecting lower dharma for higher dharma. And we see examples of people who didn't do that. Karna didn't do that. Karna would not reject his lower dharma for higher dharma. Even Bhishma Dev, of course there's something rasa going on there, something of bhakti and rasa, but at least superficially, Bhishma kept to a lower dharma rather than a higher dharma. The wives of the brahmanas, they accepted a higher dharma over a lower dharma in Krishna Lila. So here Bali's doing that, and ironically, what he's rejecting is pleasing a brahmana, which is one of the invaluable principles of the universe. So the dharma that he's rejecting, the lower dharma, is basically one of the highest dharmas in the universe. It's beyond, as we were saying earlier, it's beyond ordinary pious works. This is beyond the regulations of varna and ashrama. The service to the brahmanas and service to the devotees. Of course, Sukracharya isn't a devotee, but he's a brahmana. To reject that in order to please the Lord, that's very extraordinary on Bali's part. It's sort of an ultimate surrender. Right? We think about how many devotees make that kind of surrender, how many devotees would reject that kind of dharma. We do have to be very, very, very careful that we don't say, okay, I'm just going to be in the mode of ignorance and reject all ordinary dharma to please the Lord. Here the Lord's personally requesting. So Sukracharya then curses him, and he says, you're going to lose all your opulence. Which I think is kind of funny, because Sukracharya was worried that Bali would lose his opulence, and then he himself curses him to do so. And it's really because of this curse that Mom and Dave now takes the universe, because, again, the Lord likes to preserve the order of the universe. So Sukracharya curses Bali, and he doesn't care. He doesn't care. And Bali says a very wonderful verse in this connection. He said, if this is Vishnu coming in this form, why not give him everything? He said, I'm destined to lose everything at death. Anyway, why not give him everything voluntarily? I remember not in relation to God, in relation to family, but I remember my mother having this motto. She said, better to give with a warm hand than a cold hand. And she was a very wealthy woman, and she gave away most of her wealth during her life. So, you know, she had a charity to which she had given millions and millions of dollars, and she herself didn't die without much money. She wasn't interested in dying a very wealthy person. So she had given the vast bulk of her money to charity and some to family, but mostly she'd given to charity, to religious charity. And she would say this. She would say, you know, better to give with a warm hand than a cold hand. And this should frankly be our view in general. Why not give to the Lord everything I'm destined to lose at death anyway? You know, the Lord, you have manasadehage hayokichumor arpilu tuapade nandikishor. This is your body, this is your home, this is your wealth, this is your family, all this belongs to you. So Bali Maharaj gives. And he pours the water over Vamandev's hand. Yes, I am giving to you. Sukracharya makes so many excuses. Why not? He said, you didn't say om first, and you can lie to protect yourself and so many things. And Bali just says, no, I'm going to give. So then Vamandev assumes a Virat Rupa. And he covers the whole universe with the lower planets on his feet, the upper planets on his hair, and everything is here. Unfortunately, the way I'm showing this slideshow, I can't also see the verses. If I was showing it in a regular hall, I could see the verses, and we could read the description from the Bhagavatam. I do remember that the day and night are his eyelids, and when he would close his eyes, it was night. When he would open them, it was day. But everything in the universe, he covered with, first by expanding his body. So by expanding his body, everything was within him. And with two steps, he had covered everything. So he says to Bali, you lied to me. You told me you were going to give me three steps, and you lied. You didn't fulfill your promise. Therefore, you should be arrested as a liar and a cheater. So and then the Lord's associates come, and Bali is arrested with the ropes of Varuna. And this would be a very difficult situation. I mean, here, he's given everything to the Lord. He went against his guru, and still he was publicly humiliated. So we may think in the course of our devotional lives that if I give everything to the Lord, I should get some sort of reward externally. And we often think, you know, Lord, I've done everything for you. I've done everything you said. I did everything you wanted. And still my life is not turning out the way that I expected. And Bali didn't take this mood. Bali took a mood of, I've given everything to the Lord. And if he wants to punish me, that's his right. He had the right to take everything, and he had the right to punish me. And here we have an interesting situation where Lord Brahma, Prahlad Maharaj, who's Bali's grandfather, Bali's wife, all of them come, and they want Vamandev to forgive Bali, but they also are criticizing, even Bali's wife, they're criticizing his mood of being the master of the universe. Now, of course, as the grandson of Prahlad Maharaj, there's no question that Bali is going to be actually harmed. And this situation is not only a way to make Bali humble, because remember he was saying, oh, I'll give you something greater than anybody else has ever given you. But it's also a way of showing the amazing qualities of his devotees. And devotees are willing to do that service for the Lord. Devotees are willing to be put in a difficult situation so that the Lord can use them as an example for the people in general. Srila Prabhupada was a wealthy man, and then he became so poverty-stricken that he wouldn't have return fare on a train. He would take a train to see a potential donor, and he wouldn't have paisa for the return journey. He lived homeless almost 5 years. came to America, he says, insignificant beggar, and from a material position, you know, he really was an insignificant beggar. Spiritually, of course not, but from an external, a mundane vision. And Krishna will put his devotees into that situation that Prabhupada wasn't deterred. He didn't say, because I'm an insignificant beggar, therefore I'm going to give up my mission. You know, unless I have the accolades of kings and presidents, I'm not going to do this. He had his heart attacks on the boat and so forth. And he didn't take the mood of, you know, well, I shouldn't be treated like this. I'm such a surrendered soul. And these examples are necessary for the conditioned souls who are just starting in the process of bhakti and who need to have tatenu kampam sukshamikshamano, who need to have humility and grace under the weight of their karmic reactions. That's absolutely necessary for them. And therefore, those who are above karma, karmadi nirdhati kintu jabhakti bhaja, they often show this example, and they're willing to show this example as the Lord's servants. So this is the beautiful culmination of this story, that something shifts in Bali's heart, and he decides not just to give his possessions, but to give himself. Many times we may give our possessions without giving ourselves. And I have so many people who go to temples, churches, and mosques, and they give. They may give their time going to worship. They may give some of their wealth. They give some regular charity. But they never give themselves. They never actually surrender their heart. Even they may work lifetime for the Lord's mission, but they still don't give themselves. They may, pray every day, read the scripture every day. So many things, and one could look at them externally and say, oh, what a surrendered soul. But they may never give themselves. Giving ourselves means, I'm yours. You can do with me as you like. I am your servant. So Bali said, you with two steps, you've taken all my possessions. And I do have something left to give you, because I'm not included in my possessions. I am the possessor. So you can put your foot on my head. So Mom and Dave then said to Bali, I will give you a place better than Indra in the subterranean planets, and there I will serve you as a doorkeeper. Later, in another millennium, you will become the actual Indra. So the interesting irony is, when we give everything to the Lord, we will always get back more. We're afraid, if I give everything to the Lord, what will be left for me? What will be left for me? But when we give everything to the Lord, he will give back more. Chalayasi Vikramane Balim Bhutavamana Paranakanira Janita Janapa Vanakesha Vadrita Vamana Rupa Jaya Jagadi Sharde. All right, I think we're going to end here. As I say, we do have a plan locally tomorrow night to go a little further with this. So, if we could stop screen sharing, please.
Wonderful presentation. Any chance of Ramananda somehow televising tomorrow night's program?
I don't know if he wants to be there. Have you stopped sharing screens?
I stopped sharing my screen. Or your screen, rather.
Okay. So if we have, we have a few minutes, if anybody has any questions or comments or...
What am I missing about Bali in this pastime?
Probably a lot. I'm sure I didn't tell anywhere near. It's a very, very long. It's a very long pastime.
Well, no, just you mentioned in the beginning about how he started out really just like Hiranyakashipu or Ravana. I mean, his intention was very materialistic to overtake the heavenly planets by force,
yes,
by his own power, his own endeavor. But yet he, when push came to shove, he showed himself as such a perfect devotee, so surrendered, whereas we didn't see that in Hiranyakashipu or Ravan.
Mm.
What happened? What was the difference here?
You know, it's very hard to say what is it that causes a specific jiva to say, I surrender. Why is it? Why is it that two jivas in a similar situation? I know when I first found out about Krishna consciousness, when I first read the Bhagavad Gita, it was just so exciting. You know, it was so, so exciting. Wow, I found the truth. And at that time, I was convinced that anybody that I told about Bhagavad Gita would immediately feel the same way. I thought all I have to do is just, you know, give them a Bhagavad Gita, and they'll say, wow! But I didn't have that experience. Some people that I gave a Bhagavad Gita to said, wow, this is what I've always wanted. And some people said, oh, nothing. And what is that exactly? So we are given some idea from Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, particularly, I would say, and also Rupa Goswami and Srila Prabhupada, that what happens is whether or not a person has amassed enough of what we call agyata sukriti. So generally speaking, what happens is a person does some sort of unknowing devotion. It's not Krishna conscious because it's unconscious, but they're doing some service for the Lord or the Lord's devotees. And eventually doing that purifies their heart so that it is possible when in contact with the Lord or the Lord's devotees for some desire to awaken. That desire is there. It's eternally present in the hearts of all living entities, the desire to serve the Lord. It's our swarup, it's our constitutional nature. And this agyata sukriti, it kind of starts cleaning things off, so then in the right circumstance, you know, it's just like they sometimes have found in Egyptian tombs or whatever they found them, these chickpeas that are thousands of years old, garbanzo beans, and they're just dormant. And then in the right situation, they sprout again. Or, frogs that hibernate. And so in the right situation, it will come out if we're uncovered. You know, if the chickpeas are still in the tomb, then no matter how much sunshine and rain there is outside, they'll never sprout. If the frogs are under the mud, you know, sometimes frogs get encrusted in hard mud, and sometimes, again, they find frogs after hundreds of years of hibernation, and they're still alive. So there has to be an uncovering. Those two things, an uncovering, and then to be in the right situation. So how exactly did Bali do that? I don't know. I mean, Prahlad Maharaj is his grandfather. Perhaps he had some affection for him. That, just like Srila Prabhupada told my father, he said that if my father loved me, then that would, and I love Krishna, that would be equivalent to my father's loving Krishna. So perhaps Bali's affection for Prahlad Maharaj allowed him to engage in some of Dr. Sukriti. I mean, we have Ajamil, who was always affectionate to his son and always calling out, Narayan, please come here, Narayan, let's come to eat. And that affection for somebody named Narayana, who wasn't even a devotee, just had the name of the Lord, purified him. So this is the... we find... And this can happen very quickly with the... I was just reading about Haridas Thakur, because we're also going to speak about Haridas Thakur tomorrow night, Krishna willing. So the prostitute who went to degrade and defame Haridas Thakur, so she had a Vaishnava aparadi mentality. But just because it was the cultural behavior of the time, she offered obeisances to the Tulsi tree. And being in the presence of Haridas Thakur, hearing him chanting and just chanting along with him. But others don't do that. It's not that just because you have contact with a devotee. I mean, Hiranyakashipu had contact with Prahlad, but he obviously didn't have that real affection for Prahlad. It didn't affect him in that way, or Ravana with Vibhishan. So just because you have the opportunity doesn't mean necessarily that you take advantage of it. And why do some do and some don't? Who can say? This is the free will of the living entity that defies logic. But obviously Bali had something there that in the right circumstance awakened. When he saw Vamandev, he was filled with love and affection. And then, of course, Prahlad Maharaj came into the room, and somehow his heart stirred. And there are so many stories like this even in the modern day, even with our modern devotees, where they may be living a very materialistic life, and somehow or other, at a certain point, you know, I know of devotees who used to throw, you know, rotten fruit at the Harinam party before they were a devotee, or who avoided the devotees, but at some point there's something that sparked in the heart. It's the best I can do, I think.
That's nice, thank you.
Anybody else?
Balabhadra has a question. Balabhadra, this is the time. Oh, is Balabhadra still there? Oh, okay. Anybody else?
Yeah, I have something. Irmala Didi, I sent you a picture some time back of Vikram dressed up as Vamana.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I thought, you know, he's taking the step. He's standing on the earth. I just sent it to Ramananda.
Uh-huh.
And he could maybe flash it on the screen if he's able. But let's see. He's taking the screen. There it is.
Oh, that is okay. Such a cool picture.
He shaved up for that.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that is so totally cool.
Yeah, he was like totally into it. He actually shaved his head to play the role. So we had a play, and this we projected onto the wall when it came time for him to, you know, take the step. Yes, that's his second step. He's on his way out the universe.
Right. Thank you.
So, let's see. One other thing. I was just looking at the eighth canto, Bhagavatam, and let me see if I can pull it up here. And the first verse of the, I think it's the 19th chapter. Let me see. 18th chapter, 8.18.1. Sri Dev Goswami said, after Lord Brahma had thus spoken, glorifying the Lord's activities and prowess, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is never subject to death like an ordinary living being, appeared from the womb of Aditi. His four hands were decorated with conch shell, club, lotus, and disc. He was dressed in yellow garments, and his eyes appeared like the petals of a blooming lotus. Now, we just attended Janmashtami together, and we're on the same page that Krishna appeared in the dungeon of Kamsa as a baby form. I'm thinking the same thing is happening here. And again, it looks like Jadarani has painted this full-on Vishnu form.
No, no, the full-on Vishnu form happens at another point in the Leela.
Oh, it does.
Yes. So that full-on four-on Vishnu form appears before Aditi gets pregnant.
I see.
So she does a yajna. She does a prolonged yajna to please the Lord.
Right.
He then appears
right.
before her in a full four-on Vishnu form and says, "I'm going to become your son."
Right.
And disappears. Then she gets
right.
pregnant by her husband. And
right.
then when she gives birth to the Lord in the form of Vamana. And there's no indication that he appears as a Vishnu form at that time.
Okay, I'm going to read this verse again. 8:18:1. He appeared from the womb of Devaki. His four hands were decorated with conch, club, lotus, and disc.
Oh, maybe then.
Yeah.
So maybe even when
Shastra.
He appears. Oh, and then
we're
turns himself.
Here.
So he turns himself.
Yes, then he turns himself into Vamana. And then Prabhupada makes a comment, or it's probably Vishwanath somebody, that he can appear as an actor. He's like an actor.
Oh, so he
so
does appear as a
His body's not
form.
Material. Yeah, okay. He appears as Vishnu. Then he can change his form to anything. So he just morphs into Vamana. And that's, and he's an actor. Like, that's what's in the commentary. His body is spiritual, it's not material, and he can appear any way he likes.
Okay, so I stand corrected. That picture, though, is from a different point in the Leela.
Okay.
So that picture is from 8:17.
Mm-hmm.
When... Okay, let's see if we can find this verse.
Yeah, I'm sure you... No, I...
Here we go. It's text 4.
Yeah, it's fine.
So if you go to 8:17:4, my dear king, the original Supreme Personality of Godhead, dressed in yellow garments and bearing a conch shell disc, club, and lotus in his four hands, then appeared before Aditi. She once stood up and then fell to the ground like a rod, so she offers dandavat.
Right,
dandavat,
right.
Priti, she offers dandavats on the ground.
Right.
And she's having this ecstasy, etc. So that's that particular painting is of that. Yeah, I have never seen a painting of the other, of the Lord, actually. So I had forgotten that. Thank you.
Okay. Balabhadra is back, if he can ask this question.
Sure.
Thank you, as always, for another wonderful class. You ended your class talking about how sometimes a person gives everything, but they never really give themselves.
Mm.
They never really surrender in that respect. And, of course, my understanding is that at the time of initiation, we are making the statement that I'm going to surrender everything I have, myself, my everything.
Yes.
And yet I can only speak for myself and say that even though, you know, I maintain my sadhana, maintain my japa and everything, I have a hell of a hard time surrendering a lot of time.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering, is there a distinction between the type of surrender that you were discussing and the type of surrender that we make at the time of initiation, or what is that, you know?
Well, I think at the time of initiation, some people probably actually surrender everything. That depends. For most of us, initiation is more, I'm working on it, and I'm making a vow that I'm going to do it. But the word initiate means a beginning, to initiate, to begin. So initiation is the formal beginning of the journey. Of course, in one sense, it began prior to that. It's hard to say exactly when it begins. But that's the formal beginning. It's not the culmination. It's not expected that at initiation, just like another example, if we talk about something a little bit more tangible. So at initiation, we vow to chant a minimum of 16 rounds of the Hare Krishna mantra every day. And Srila Prabhupada frequently at initiation lectures speaks about the 10 offenses to chanting. And it's expected that when we are beginning our chanting, we are chanting with some of those offenses. That's expected. Srila Prabhupada does not say, I will only initiate you if you're already chanting offenseless chanting. So when we say I'm going to chant 16 rounds every day, it's understood that those rounds are probably going to be offensive. But over time, they should become actually Shudanam. We should be really chanting the pure holy name. We don't want to continue on with those offenses. Prabhupada would often make the point, don't stay at Kalista Adhikari. Don't stay at Prakriti Bhakta. Make sure that you advance. I just listened to a talk the other day where Prabhupada used the Shrama Evi Kevalam verse in that connection, which kind of was upsetting to me. But he was saying, you know, it's all useless. If you don't come to spontaneous devotion, it's all useless. So I see that for most of us, when we take initiation, we're saying, my desire is a full surrender. My desire, my intention is a full surrender. But at that time, it certainly isn't. Of course, it may be a full surrender according to our capacity at that time. That's another way of looking at it. So it's just like I'm homeschooling my grandkids here. They're all different ages. So my 13-year-old granddaughter was showing me a draft of one of her compositions. And I said, look, you should fix this and fix that. And her 10-year-old sister was making some points about how it was perfectly fine as it was. It didn't need to be changed. And I said, well, it is perfectly fine for a 10-year-old. In fact, for a 10-year-old, it's a very good piece of writing, but for a 13-year-old, it's not. So our best is also very relative. You know, as a beginning devotee, we may be surrendering everything that we are conscious of. As far as our awareness, our consciousness, our understanding, we may be giving everything. We may not even have an awareness of what we're not giving. We may not even see it. And it appears to us, well, I'm doing a full surrender. So on an absolute platform, we're probably not. On a relative platform, we might be. We really might be, according to our level of maturity. And the funny thing is, as you mature in Krishna consciousness, you see how contaminated you are. I mean, just a couple weeks ago, I got a message like that... You know, I went out on a traveling Harinam party, and one of the things I realized was how much envy I have. And the person writing it to me said, I didn't realize I had any envy in my heart at all. So that's also a point there. But full surrender, that, if you want to look at full surrender, that has six items, which is also part of this presentation, but I didn't show it. And the six items are surrender, is to do what is pleasing to the Lord, to not do anything that displeases Him, to consider that the Lord is my only source of protection, not look for an independent source of protection, that the Lord is my only master, He is my only maintainer, I don't think that I can independently maintain myself, to have no separate interest from that of the Lord, which Prabhupada also explains as understanding that I'm not independent in fulfilling my desires, that I'm dependent on the Lord for the fulfillment of all of my desires. I don't go elsewhere. And then finally, total humility. Not maintaining this concept that I am great, I am significant, I am the doer, and so forth. But this deep gratitude for all the gifts of the Lord. So that's full surrender.
Seems that when Krishna sees a desire.
You know what? Mother Mahalakshmi has been patiently waiting.
Let's ask her, because it's getting late.
Hare Krishna. It's similar, the question is how much we hear about the importance of surrender. We may practice that in level of giving materially speaking, but what is going to help us to really give ourselves in this process of surrender?
That's a little bit actually of a different question. What's going to help us to surrender is faith. The reason we surrender according to our degree of faith. So if I believe that Krishna will be my protector, then I accept that He's my protector. If I don't have that faith, then I think, well, okay, you know, he can protect me, but mostly I'll protect myself, or I'll depend on my family members or government or my friends or something like that. So it depends on what we have faith and conviction in. So how do we deepen our faith and conviction? Well, one way is to be with people who have more faith than we have, and to have their association, and we start to experience with them how their faith sustains them. And this was what I was mentioning earlier about even great devotees will sometimes show their faithfulness in difficult situations as a service to the Lord, so that they're giving an example to us. That we see that Bali Maharaj, never, his faith never wavered, even when his guru rejected him. I mean, wouldn't that just push most of us over the edge? You know, if our guru rejects us, we become scared, and, well, maybe I'm doing the wrong thing, and maybe I shouldn't surrender to Krishna. What to speak of when Krishna himself arrested him? I mean, wow, you know, if I gave every single thing I own, every single thing, you know, if Krishna walked in the door of this room right now and said, give me everything in this room, and I gave him everything, and then he said, you didn't give me enough, and he tied me up in front of everybody. You know, if he shamed me in front of the whole ISKCON and tied me up, and you didn't give me enough, I'd probably just be angry. I'd say, what kind of a god are you anyway? I gave you everything you asked for, and then all you do is humiliate me and ask for more. You know, I would just be annoyed or angry. But Bali shows this example that he maintained his faithfulness. He didn't waver one iota. He didn't say, oh, you're being unfair. And he didn't waver. He did say to the Lord, you know, you don't usually punish people like this. This is a little excessive. But he didn't waver in his faith. And by being with people like that, we gain faith. We see, uh-oh, that's how it's done. If they can do it, I can do it. And we see that everything was restored. Everything was restored. And, I mean, I've personally seen this with other people in the modern Gaudiya Sangha, that sometimes they will lose so much that it's just beyond my comprehension how they're going on, and they're still happy. And I also see that everything becomes restored to them. It's quite fascinating to me. I've seen people become, you know, worldwide defamation, or extreme poverty, or extreme illness, or extreme family rejection. You know, really, really extreme things, where they go through some terrible, terrible crisis. And if they maintain their faith and they maintain their happiness, then I see that everything gets restored. And looking at that example and knowing them, it gives me faith. And then the other way that we get faith is by our little bits of surrender. I remember one devotee compared this, and to those of you who've never been around ice, this won't make any sense, but to those of us who've been in climates that have winters. So I used to live across the street from a lake. And in the winter, the lake would freeze over and we would go ice skating on it. But unlike a man-made ice rink where they tell you, oh, it's safe to skate and stuff, but we had to test it. So we would go on the edge of the lake and we'd like throw rocks on it to see if the ice would hold our weight. And you gradually throw bigger and bigger rocks further and further out. And then at a certain point, you put on your ice skates and you skate all over the lake. So, you know, we try surrendering a little bit to Krishna. And we see that whatever we give is given back with interest. And we see that our happiness is not affected. And then we get faith and we give a little more. And we give a little more, and we give a little more. And each time we give a little more, and each time we surrender a little more, we see that there's no loss or diminution. And in fact, we become happier. Sometimes we become happier because we're relieved of the burden. Sometimes we become happier because Krishna then restores everything to us in another way. So I think by associating with people who have more faith than we do, and hearing about their experiences and seeing their own life, And then also through experimenting ourselves, pratyaksha bhagavan karma, doing our own experiment with surrender. Unfortunately, sometimes we think, well, first I want the assurance, and then I'll surrender. And then we never get the assurance. One has to first surrender without the assurance. That's what surrender means. Surrender means I give without any assurance. Without, I have no idea what's going to happen. I do this favorable thing, or I give up this unfavorable thing, and I have no idea what the result is, but I just trust. And then when we get the result and we find, wow, that's amazing, then our faith increases. But if we wait and we say, well, first I've got to have full conviction, then it doesn't happen. Then first I have to have everything set up, and then that's not how the spiritual process works. Okay, I do have to stop now. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.